so I'll turn it over today to our first speaker, which is Dr. Kavita Avula. Dr. Kavita Avula is a licensed clinical psychologist who specializes in international and cross-cultural psychology, organizational resilience, trauma and critical incidents response. She's on the faculty of the Washington School of Psychiatry's National Group Psychotherapy Institute. As founder of Therapists Beyond Borders, Dr. Avula encourages organizations to flourish through developing a holistic approach to the well-being of employees that includes all levels of the organization and are set up to thrive. Dr. Avula serves as lead consulting psychologist for the Kantara Group and consulting psychologist to the World Bank Group's Personal and Work Stress Counseling Unit, where she provides organizational consultation to humanitarian aid organizations. She's got a lot of experience around the world in Mexico, Tanzania, Uganda, Kenya, Afghanistan, Ukraine, Palestine, the Philippines, Peru, and India. Dr. Avula provides psychological support to individuals and groups living or working in high-stress environments. And they're not the same high-stress environments that we work in. They're much higher. She currently consults to Georgetown University's Office of the President on a range of topics, including an initiative that strives to shift the culture in higher education to one that embraces flourishing as integral to the college experience. Dr. Avula speaks on topics including building cultural competence, understanding microaggressions, developing a better response to sexual harassment, and creating flourishing communities. Her talk is titled Inside Out and Outside In, Cultural Sensibility and Globalization. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Kavita Avula.
Thank you, Susan, for the warm introduction. And good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. I was relaxing at an African bush camp where I was on a break from work related to the Westgate Mall attacks in Nairobi some years ago, and I found myself chatting with the 2-year-old Kenyan girl. At one point, she pointed at me and declared to her father, "Muzungu." He laughed and averted his eyes, amused and not quite sure what to do with it. Having had my share of cross-cultural encounters as an international psychologist, I was certain I knew what she had said. I asked her father what Muzungu meant, and he confirmed my hunch. It means white person. You might think of my skin color as unequivocally brown, and from the inside out, I would agree that my skin color is brown. From the outside in, however, it's been a different story. It's these types of nuances that I hope to pique your interest around this morning, the ones that aren't so readily apparent or frequently spoken of, but which can help you develop the awareness necessary to forge better cross-cultural relations. A little about me. My journey in cross-cultural relating began at the ripe age of 2, when my family moved from my birthplace in India to Brooklyn, New York. If you want to talk about cultural shock, I went from this to this. As you think about your first foray into globalizing your work, or for others continuing on that path, I hope to highlight some of the underlying dynamics inherent in every cross-cultural interaction. These are often not as obvious, but play a major role in whether an individual from another culture feels patronized by you or connected to in a meaningful way. Here's a snapshot of where I have traveled for work in recent years. My organization, Therapists Beyond Borders, helps organizations to look at how to help staff flourish every day and also after a crisis. So in 2010, I did some work in Ramallah, Palestine. I've been to Kabul, Afghanistan 3 times. As I mentioned already, I was in Kenya after the Westgate Mall attacks. I went to the Philippines after Typhoon Haiyan some years ago. And then when there was civil unrest in Kyiv, Ukraine, and Russia annexed Crimea, I went to Kyiv. In 2016, there was an outbreak of violence in South Sudan, and so I met evacuees from that country in Uganda and in Tanzania. And then most recently, I went to Mexico City after the earthquakes. Cross-cultural skills are not just relevant abroad. Developing awareness around issues of culture and difference can benefit us all right here at home as well. Kenya is not the first place a child has seen my skin as white. When I was working at a Head Start center about 5 hours away from here in inner city Chicago, the toddlers at the all-African American school ran their fingers through my hair and asked me what it was like to be white. I was shocked and thought, I have no idea. Looking back, I think I do have some idea given the privilege I hold as an Indian person, a member of a minority group that is associated with more positive stereotypes and is less stigmatized than some others in the US. It certainly carries a different set of implications for my personal sense of safety and self-worth to be labeled as smart rather than dangerous, for example. Recent events have painfully demonstrated the repercussions of the latter. If Tamir Rice, who is from Cleveland, had been a different shade of skin color, the outcome of his playing with his toy gun at a playground nearby might not have culminated so tragically. These dynamics of privilege and power take hold in every society around the world. The more you're aware of the dynamics at home, the more you'll be tuned in to those abroad. Today, I would like to highlight some forces, some less visible than others, that can get in the way of creating or building successful relationships across culture. I'll be highlighting implicit bias, microaggressions, cultural imperialism, and I would like to encourage you to take a step back and take a wider lens to global research and to think about what it means to develop a cultural sensibility so that you can have more meaningful relationships across cultural boundaries. If I lived in India, being brown wouldn't be so much of an issue. Instead, I would be sized up in terms of the level of my brownness. Since there are many people who have a similar skin color to mine in India, shades of color become the focal point with a clear preference for being fair or light-skinned. People are socialized from the time they are born to associate light skin with beauty, status, intelligence, prowess, and many other desirable qualities. In most places around the world, with each darkened shade of brown skin, life is that much harder. Many women in India receive the message from the time they can walk that they should strive to be lighter. And it's not just limited to the women either. Take my youngest sister, for example, who is a shade or two darker than me. She has had to deal with far more racial slurs and prejudice than I have. Whenever I'm giving a talk on race or culture, I call her because she can reliably provide a story of racism any given week. Her experience in this country and outside is defined by the shade of her skin. In contrast, my other sister, who is much lighter skinned, took 20 minutes to think of an example of discrimination based on skin color, and the experience she came up with was well into her adulthood. The main point to highlight about implicit bias is that it's something that we do unconsciously, which means that we don't realize that we're doing it. The very early age at which socialization occurs, and with it the internalization of socio-historical political constructs of privilege and power, still astounds me. Whether the most accurate terms are used or not, difference is clearly registered for those groups of people who have been routinely marginalized, colonized, and demeaned by the world society. We have to work together to create greater awareness in ourselves and in each other about issues like implicit bias and the automaticity of race-based stereotyping. I know of implicit testing in the field of sensory science and would like to distinguish implicit bias from it. Implicit bias refers to the attitudes or stereotypes that affect our understanding, actions, and decisions in an unconscious manner. Implicit bias happens quickly without our realizing it. These biases, which can encompass both favorable and unfavorable assessments, they're activated involuntarily without an individual's awareness or intentional control. Residing deep in the subconscious, these biases are different from known biases that individuals may choose to conceal for the purposes of social and/or political correctness. An implicit bias is what generally tends to lead people to stereotype others. A stereotype is a widely held but fixed and oversimplified image or idea of a person, type, or thing. For me, the conversation often goes like this. Where are you from? I was born in India. oh, you're from Bombay? Or, oh, I have an Indian coworker, maybe you know her. Or, my doctor is Indian, really smart guy. When I hear any of these in a social situation, I begrudgingly go along with it, smile politely, and I internally roll my eyes. The first one, you're from Bombay, at first glance tells me the person doesn't think of India as a whole country, or if they do, they think that all of the people live in one city. Or perhaps they're trying to connect by showing that they know that there's a city called Bombay in India. But if one wouldn't guess which city an American is from upon first meeting them, why would one assume that every Indian comes from Bombay? I know that people aren't trying to irritate me by asking those questions. Most likely they mean well, but perhaps a combination of societal norms, anxiety, and ignorance misguide the questions. Notice the different feeling if the same curiosity comes in the form of an open-ended question that gives me the opportunity to share something about my experience. What part of India specifically are you from? Or what has it been like for you to go back? Or how much has the Indian part of your identity stayed with you? Good questions are ones in which you genuinely show interest without showing off your knowledge or displaying your assumptions. Sometimes that first conversation goes like this. Where are you from? I was born in India but grew up in New York. How old were you when you came to the US? I was almost two. Ah, so you're really American then. When I hear this very common assumption, it makes my blood boil but I rarely acknowledge that to the person who's talking to me. It's never a good idea to tell someone what his or her identity is. Asking open-ended questions and letting the person use the words to describe who they are makes more sense. The impact of unconscious bias is strong and continually affects all of our interactions, which so many don't realize when it's happening. We often think of stereotypes as negatives, but there can also be positive stereotypes. Positive stereotypes are no different from negative ones in terms of their impact. Generalizing a person to a larger group, collective theme, or idea can have the impact of devaluing that person, even if the idea or intent behind it was positive. Along with negative stereotypical remarks, they tend to be perceived as dismissive and insulting, both to that person and to their culture. And these are some examples of some of the unhelpful positive stereotypes that we have in our culture. So thinking of all African Americans as great athletes, or referring to Asian women as exotic or smart. This is a very compelling statistic from my field of work. Studies have documented that 50% of ethnic minorities do not return to psychotherapy after the first visit. We believe that one of the major reasons that clients don't come back is due to the lack of cultural humility and the impact of microaggressions committed by the unsuspecting therapist. Cultural humility involves the stance that while you may know something about the client's background from your research or experience, it's still necessary to be curious about and opening to discovering who they are according to them. I'll admit that I represent a part of that statistic as a person who didn't go back to her first therapist after the first session. The highly recommended older white female therapist told me with a gentle smile on her face, "I know how passive Indian women are." One poorly formulated sentence can have that much of an impact. She had boxed me into a category I was all too familiar with in terms of people projecting their biases onto me. I don't consider myself to be a passive woman in any sense of the word, and I had no interest in telling her this. I didn't want to start a relationship by proving her biases wrong. I wanted my therapist to be open to knowing me by listening and intuiting well. If we wish to connect with people from other cultures, we have to be aware that our ignorance may put them off. We can offend others easily and without knowing it. We have to pay attention to what we say and how we say it. This does not mean that we have to walk on eggshells or have a filter for what we say all of the time. It doesn't mean always speaking in a politically correct way or avoiding any joking whatsoever with cultural references. It means having awareness about the choices we make and thinking about the impact that we have on the people around us. A study by Johnson in 2004 showed that even black doctors showed some signs of discrimination against their black patients. This illustrates just how powerful social norms can be in shaping one's view of themselves in the world from the outside in. In another study, that sought to assess the effect of Afrocentric features in people found that it was not just race, but physical features associated with marginalized groups that were more likely to lead to stereotyping and a negative view of those people. The study concluded that the broader the nose and the fuller the lips, the more likely it was that the face would be assigned a negative valence regardless of whether the face was white or black. I'll review the Starbucks example in just a moment. And so in the recent years, we've seen the Black Lives Matter movement come to the fore in direct response to the implicit bias that goes on in our culture, and we have numerous examples of that from recent years. The implicit associations that we hold don't necessarily align with our declared beliefs or even reflect the stances that we would explicitly endorse. And we generally hold implicit biases that tend to favor the dominant group. And this is not just a trend for white individuals. Implicit bias is in all of us, including people of color. We are all the products of socialization and take in many messages biasing us against one another without realizing it. People of color become biased against other people of color, and sadly, people of color unconsciously get biased against themselves. At 4 years old, when I was in preschool, I can assure you that no one mistook me for a Muzungu. At the Jewish Community Center, my peers did not see an American. They saw a brown-skinned, quote, Indian. The kids called me Pocahontas and ran around me making the rhythmic sound with their hands clapping over their mouths, so stereotypically associated with Native Americans. One day of my four-year-old existence, to my poor mother's shock, I sauntered into the kitchen with stark white talcum powder slathered all over my face, apparently convinced this had done the trick. My mother almost fell over as she tried to understand what was going on. She didn't need a diploma in psychology to see that her preschooler already knew something about culture. It saddens me now to think that the realization of my cultural self was immediately followed by an attempt to white it out. Many children of color, unbeknownst to their parents, are socialized to believe that belonging to the dominant race is better. Being white can mean to be liked, to fit in, to be envied, to be normal, to have someone to play with. These examples illustrate just how context-dependent the self is. At an African bush camp, I can be considered white, even though I'm brown, and in nursery school, I'm considered the Native American type of Indian, though I'm Indian from India. Today, when I go to India, I'm told I'm not Indian, I'm American, because of the way I look. Meanwhile, in the US, when an Indian woman who looks like me gets crowned Miss America, social media goes nuts with outraged messages that she's not American enough because of the way she looks. Knowing what your biases are is the first step to countering the powerful forces of privilege and power found in every culture. The good news is that we can become less biased and operate in more respectful ways. The brain is plastic and therefore malleable, and we're all capable of change. So it turns out you can teach an old dog new tricks. A recent example of implicit bias is in the example of Starbucks. Last year in April 2018, African-American men were arrested for sitting down and not ordering something. They were waiting for their friend. And so that implicit bias, where we have attitudes that we don't realize are negative towards another group, can come out in disturbing and forceful ways. Starbucks' response to that was doing a racial bias training. So this is one example of how you can de-bias your organization against these types of dynamics. So they took 180,000 employees, closed 8,000 stores for 3 hours across the US, and did some work. And I would say that is a start, right? That's the tip of the iceberg. What are microaggressions? Microaggressions are brief, commonplace, hostile, derogatory, or negative slights towards or insults towards marginalized groups. Those who use microaggressions are often completely unaware of their impact. And these can be directed at any marginalized group. Some people think that they're being complimentary, for instance, when they refer to Indians as smart or Indian women as exotic. These types of phrases, however, assume whiteness as the norm and tend to otherize those who don't fit that norm. They set standards that an individual may not be able to or may not want to meet. How these phrases have been used historically weighs into their current connotation. So here are some examples of common microaggressions. If a person is walking down the street and they clutch their belongings when a dark-skinned man approaches them or walks by. Or recent example in Portland, just last month, an Asian American born in the US and is complimented for speaking good English when they don't speak any other language. To give you an example, I'd like to briefly talk about cultural imperialism, which is the process and practice of promoting one's culture over another. It can manifest in very obvious and overt forms, like occupation by a foreign power and subsequent suppression of the local culture, or it can take more subtle and less obvious forms. The majority of international work that I do consists of providing organizational consultation to humanitarian aid organizations who set up assistance for those residing in conflict-affected areas. There are some incredibly intelligent expatriate staff that lead these programs who all too often find cultural sensitivity discussions to be superfluous. They've been to so many countries, they already know, they tell me. This sits in stark contrast to what I hear from the local staff of the host country, who experience expats all too often as culturally imperialistic instead of as benevolent or as helpful. In every country that I've visited, the locals tell a different story. The national staff reliably describe an arrogant, condescending air among the international staff and express anger and hurt about not being taken seriously about development happening in their country. These reactions are, for the most part, once again, unspoken. Usually there's one expat who gets it. In the rare cases in which that expat leads the team, a more harmonious, respectful, cooperative tone embodies the work that's done, and the morale is much higher among that group. The system, as much as the individuals working within it, are responsible. Since most donors funding their work are focused on deliverables and what's getting done, aid organization staff can lose sight of the most basic elements of forging good relationships and the primary motivation that attracted them to this type of work in the first place. Being thoughtful, compassionate, respectful, and considering context can make the difference between coming across as collaborative and coming across as insulting. Historically, the way that cultural imperialism has been expressed was an overt domination of one culture by another. For example, many countries have experienced language, religion, and dress code suppression and replacement with another culture when another culture invades. Here you can see how Māori language was banned in schools in New Zealand. We're not short on examples of where this has happened throughout the world when new cultures come into another country and take over. Cultural imperialism tends to be a more forceful method that pushes the projected ideologies and methods from the outside in to the dominated culture. A culturally humble approach to globalization, on the other hand, tends to present the new ideologies, methods, and products to the intended culture and allows them to make the choice to adopt these new ways. Clearly, to be successful in this goal, one would need to tailor the product and ideas to be attractive to the targeted culture. The result of such globalization is the potential supplanting of aspects of one culture in the process. In this way, globalization can be an insidious agent in homogenizing world cultures, which carried to the extreme could make the world an overall duller and less interesting place. I believe that we need to develop what I call a cultural sensibility. This means doing more than researching a culture or reading tips on Country Navigator before you travel. You can have all of the knowledge in the world, but if you don't know how to use it in a respectful way, it's of little value. Being sensible means being color conscious, culture conscious, understanding how the dynamics of privilege and power are at play, having a flexible framework, and embracing the within group differences and cultures, and being thoughtful and curious about every individual that's in front of you. It means having a flexible framework that takes into account that there are far more differences within every culture than between cultural groups. It's one thing to go to another culture to share ideas and to create a more delicious morning experience while being aware of the possibility of replacing the local culture's norms. It's another to go in with the mentality that we do it better and striving to replace local foods at any cost. Every person is a cultural being, no matter what shade they are. My husband is also an immigrant. He's a white man who is from Ireland and came to live in the US in his early 20s. His entire family still resides there. As a white male in this country, of course, he carries a level of privilege. However, as an immigrant in some ways, he doesn't. He has an Irish accent, and his way of speaking brings him unwanted attention on a regular basis. I can't count the number of middle-aged women who swoon over his accent and go on and on about how cute and adorable it is. As he tries to complete his train of thought, the woman predictably brims over with glee over how charming his accent is, barely able to concentrate on what he's saying. Imagine how this feels at work when he's at a work meeting and talking to his colleagues. I won't even get started on the regular jokes about Guinness and drinking. Like me, he wanted to rid himself of the undesirable attention and worked hard to cover up his accent and use the phrases more commonly used in this country. Each person has their own story. Work to hear what it is from the inside out instead of projecting your biases from the outside in. You can still be an expert in your field of knowledge while being humble in understanding cultural nuances. In that openness, you build a stronger relationship with your clientele. I hope to have increased your awareness just a little bit of how frequently implicit bias and inadvertent microaggressions can occur, and to have fostered a greater appreciation for the many cultural nuances that exist in every interaction, whether here or there. It is my hope that you will hone your own intuition by listening well, making your unconscious biases conscious, and caring about how you come across to your clients, colleagues, and global counterparts. As global sensory researchers, hopefully, you will consider infusing cultural humility into your work and take a wider lens by considering the potentially far-reaching impacts of your research on the larger cultural dynamics. In the moment that we can give voice to the different shades of self that reside in each of us and work to authentically listen and see people for who they are, we have taken an important step towards respectful, mutually enhancing cross-cultural engagement. If we do this right, perhaps one day the world can be everyone's oyster. Thank you.